So yesterday we had a lovely evening tea at our monastery, and we were talking about, how we do live in quite a death-averse culture. It's a culture where this is not often spoken about. I think they have something called a death cafe nowadays, which is like a place that you can speak freely about death, but notice how they have to put you in a separate room, right? So you have to have that designated for that theme, which is very, very healthy, I must say, and I'd quite enjoy going to one of those. But we can have our own death cafe here today and also practice, some meditation around that. Because many of us are in denial, even though we don't think we are. The fact is that when we're faced with something challenging, we see where our attachment truly resides. And I had an encounter that could have been an encounter with death. It always could. Right? We're never sure. About 5 years ago, or 6 years ago now, I think, when I saw this very funky mole on my arm that had always been a really cool shape, I suddenly thought, it's a bit bigger than it used to be. It's like looking really weird now. And then one day it started bleeding and scabbing, and I was like, oh, this is definitely a melanoma. And, within an instant, it was like, the perception of my life as going on probably for another 10, 20, 30, 40 years was like, the prognosis could be 5 years. That's kind of the average prognosis, I think, if it spread. So it was very interesting because I went to have it tested and it was indeed a melanoma. And I had a whole weekend to myself to kind of percolate on this without having, a date for the to have it removed. And because it was on the outside of my body, I could see it growing day by day. So it was quite confronting. And what I noticed is that even though I thought I was not so attached to my life and probably ready to die at any time, at least I wouldn't have so much hard work to do to establish this monastery, someone else could take over. Even though I thought that way, I would have moments of like a visceral kind of fear that would sweep through my body just completely unexpectedly throughout the day, as if this reality that's usually in the background buried somewhere was now very present and it was much closer to the surface. So I would have this kind of trembling and I'd have to just stand and go, whoa, this is interesting. Like this visceral sense of fragility and not being able to, just this sense that nothing was actually so solid as I presumed. But then the other really nice thing about this was it would swing to moments of utter gratitude and a feeling of unconditional love for the guests that were staying with me or for anyone that I would see. There'd just be this sense of the heart opening. And I think that was related to, what the Buddha says is the advantage of reflecting on the first noble truth of suffering, the fact that this is a universal situation that we're all in together. And he often talked about suffering as pain, dissatisfaction, unpleasantness, not getting what we want, etc. But at the deeper level, he actually said that suffering is simply birth and death. And this is what is existential suffering. This is something deeper than what we can kind of navigate through skillful means, right? There is the psychological aspect, which certainly reinforces our fear of death. I don't want this, I want to hold on to the people that I love, and I'm not ready to let go of my possessions, let alone my body, let alone my knowledge, right? And all the qualities that I've developed in my life. But still, the actual, death in and of itself, even if we're, ready for it, it's still suffering. We still have to let go. And this is something none of us can escape from. So it was very interesting for me to experience this and to see that by being open to my experience, I felt more connected to others in a really beautiful way. And it makes me wonder, like if we really had at the top of our minds, at the front of our minds, this idea that I could die at any time, the person that I'm irritated with or that I just sent an angry email to could die at any time, would we be the same way? Would we treat ourselves the same way? Would we be so obsessed with the petty worries and trivia in our lives? Would we actually speak to that person who's irritating us with more kindness because we would see their fragility, we would see that they too are subject to old age, sickness, and death. They're sensitive, they're vulnerable, just like us. So this is where we can really start to change our mindset, and through the cultivation of death contemplation, we can actually develop wholesome qualities. And that was one of the reasons the Buddha suggested the practice of mindfulness of death. So in the suttas, mindfulness of death is understood as one of the four rakitas, which means the four protections of our mind. And these themes actually protect us from greed, hate, and delusion. So death is one of them. Loving kindness is another. Recollecting the qualities of the Buddha is another one. And also, interestingly, reflecting on the unattractive nature of the body. So it's not, some people call it repulsiveness meditation, which sounds like really gross, right? We're thinking about blood, pus, gore, whatever, and the smell that the body emits. But really the purpose of this is not to turn away and get aversion to the body, but just to get a balanced kind of understanding that this body that we try to dress up with makeup or with, I don't know, a nice hairdo or cosmetic surgery in some cases. That's really big in places like Korea. Apparently nowadays they have to have some kind of certificate to say they've had plastic surgery because they don't look anything like their passport photo. And even more than that, everybody's having the same face. So they've got this one idea about beauty. And we can laugh about this, right? But are we really immune to that? We have one idea about beauty, and anyone who is different is somehow shunned, right? And how many of us spend so much time trying to look pleasing and attractive and acceptable to others, you know, based on this body, which anyway is decaying and dying and deteriorating every day. Recently, I keep getting all these letters coming through. One of them is like, remember to have your eyes checked. And I have to admit, I thought these were reading glasses, but I'm finding I need them to see you at the back. So I don't know what's going on with my eyes. I thought it was just for reading. But my eyes are certainly deteriorating fast. The other thing that I've noticed is my teeth. Everyone says I've got good teeth. They're quite good, pretty solid. My mum wouldn't let me have sugar when I was young, which I was not too pleased about. But that meant I never had any fillings. So I always thought, great, my teeth are great. You know, I haven't got a single filling. I'm good to go. But then the dentist said, you're brushing too hard. That's why you've got all these like receding gums and holes at the top. And apparently they can go from there. So even though I might not have fillings, my teeth will probably just start to fall out from the top. So next time you see me, I don't know. I might have, what do you call that thing? Dentures? I might have dentures, right? So there are all these signs in front of our eyes, but we don't want to see them. You know, what about our parents? Like, have a look if you have parents who are still alive. They're quite different from how they were when you were young. You know, my teacher, Ajahn Brahm, we all thought of him as the superhero, kind of endless energy. He can just get off a plane in Singapore after no sleep, start giving talks that evening, give a retreat the whole day till 10 o'clock signing autographs, and he just bounces back the next day. Now he's tired, chronically so, because he too is subject to old age, sickness, and death. Sometimes people think if you're a meditator, you're not going to get sick. And if you're sick, there's something wrong with you. This is what the Buddha called the conceit of health. Yeah, there's also these reflections we do, five reflections. We say we're supposed to practice this every day as monastics. I am subject to aging. I have not gone beyond aging. I am subject to sickness. I've not gone beyond sickness. I'm subject to death. I've not gone beyond dying. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise. Will become separated from me, inevitably, no matter how hard we try to cling to the people and the things that we love. There has to come a time that we're separated. We're born into this world alone, and we have to leave this world on our own. It's a deeply personal thing to die. You know, you can have people at your bedside for a while, and I'll talk about how they can help you, remind you of all your good qualities and how not to be afraid. But ultimately, we have to face the pain of dying. and many people opt to die alone. Quite interestingly, it's when the loved ones leave the room that the people feel they have permission to die, they have the space to die. And we have to, you know, learn how to be with ourselves, how to be alone. And the last reflection we're supposed to do every day, I'm giving it away, aren't I? Maybe I don't do this every day, is to reflect that all beings are the owners of their karma, heir to their karma. Whatever karma we will do, whatever action we do, basically, whatever qualities we cultivate in our life, of that we will be the heir. So we don't take our body, we don't take, you know, even our memories, but we do take the qualities we develop in our lives. And this is one of the reasons the Buddha advised us to contemplate mindfulness of death, because it undermines greed, hate, and delusion by undermining our attachments to life and to our body and to the things that, you know, really aren't going to bring us lasting satisfaction in the way we wish they would. And instead, we get this spiritual sense of urgency. So I wanted to read a couple of quotes. The first one is from the Marinasati Sutta, and this is to help us understand that our life really could end at any time. It ends at any age. People of all ages die, believe it or not. And there's a lovely simile Ajahn Brahm gives for this. You know, when somebody came to him and said, "Why does my child die at such a young age?" And he gave the simile of the leaves on a tree in a storm. You know, there's a storm raging throughout the night, causing havoc and bringing down branches. And usually it's the old branches and the old dead leaves that fall down to the ground. But sometimes it's the young ones. It's the young branches and the green tender leaves. And it's just the same as that in life. Sometimes, for unknown reasons, a person, you know, dies young. They're born maybe with a chronic condition, or they develop that later on. Or they get a virus and, you know, their life is cut short. And we think this is wrong, but this is still part of nature. This is part of the way things are. So we can die at any age, we can die at any time, and we can die in any way. We were on the train actually coming here today. I decided I might get more sleep if I left at Oxford on the same day. But of course, I was awake most of the night thinking, has my alarm gone? Has my alarm gone? Oh, this is my life. Anyway, but we ended up speaking to this really impressive young man, actually, highly intelligent and very inspiring. He runs his own business, but he also meditates. I think he's from a Sri Lankan background, raised in the UK. And from the age of about 20, he's been meditating and says that it gives him enormous focus, productivity, perspective, and ability to see the best in other people and to see the opportunities that are in the world. And he said, I know it's not just for that, but it really helps him in his life. But one time he was doing his triathlon training somewhere in London, and to his amazement, he was going along this road which should have been safe, and this guy just turned straight into him. And he said his first thought was like, no, he can't be doing this. And he realized basically he was about to die, and managed to have the presence of mind to turn his wheel. But the bike got completely smashed and he flew over the bonnet of this car. And his thought at that time is, oh, I'm going to die. How will my family deal with it? And then it changed into realizing that he was actually fine. He got away with a scrape and he felt enormous gratitude to be alive. But still had the presence of mind to run after the driver who'd scarpered. Unbelievable, isn't it? Yeah, he knew that this guy had gone over his bonnet, but he just tried to run away, and he ran after him and said, excuse me, you just knocked me over and I went over the bonnet of your car. And didn't get angry at all. But I was just really impressed, you know, that I think his practice might have saved his life there, because he was so aware of the moment that he needed to just turn that wheel that it stopped the car going right over him. So it can come for any reason. And the Buddha says this. He says, monks, or let's say monastics, or people, community, to be inclusive, mindfulness of death, when developed and cultivated, is of great fruit and benefit. So he's not asking us to do this because it's miserable to think about death. He's asking us to do this for our benefit. Here, when day has receded and night has approached, a person reflects thus. I could die on account of many causes, such as snake bite, falling, food poisoning, or disturbance of the, let's say, elements in the body. Here they call it bile, phlegm, or wind. This is how they understood the body in those days. It basically means any kind of imbalance. So one should reflect thus. Do I have any bad, unwholesome qualities that have not been abandoned, which might be an obstacle for me if I were to die tonight? If one sees one has, then one should put forth extraordinary desire, effort, zeal, enthusiasm, indefatigability. Did I say that right? Mindfulness and clear comprehension to abandon those unwholesome qualities, to encourage spiritual effort here and now. So this is how mindfulness of death can help us. And interestingly, this is what started the Buddha's own search. He actually was protected, as many of you might know, from the realities of death and aging and even sickness in this palace. In fact, he had about three palaces. So when it was too hot in one, he'd move to the other one, which was just right. And when it was too cold there, he'd move back down to the summer palace or whatever. And his father protected him so that he wouldn't ever want to leave. And he could enjoy all the things that, you know, the life of a prince had to offer, the women, the music, the riches, and become a world-ruling monarch. That was one of the predictions that was given when he was young. But one day, he decided to leave the palace, and this is before he actually set out on his journey to enlightenment, and he was confronted with an old person, a sick person, and a dead person. And also, luckily, a spiritual person, a holy person, someone who was obviously seeking the way out. And he realized at that time that no one was free from death. He was very shocked, actually. This is what happens if we don't contemplate death very often. We are in shock when it happens. Have you ever had like someone speak to you and talk about a relative and how sick they are? And, you know, how they really hope they're going to be okay and they don't know why it's happened to this relative. You know, what did they do to deserve this sickness? They've got cancer. They're dying. Hopefully they'll be okay. And then you ask them, how old is your relative? 96. Have you ever had that conversation? Yeah, people still don't realize it's happening even at that age. So the Buddha, in this case, was in shock. And luckily, because he saw the holy person also, or the person on a spiritual search, he realized perhaps there is a way out. And his whole journey to enlightenment was based on this desire or wish or, how can we say, urge to find the solution to birth and death. I guess in that culture at that time, you know, there was this very strong understanding that there is a way out of birth and death. We don't really have that in the West because we tend to miss out from the teachings of the Buddha, the aspect of rebirth, right? We kind of think it's all about this one life. And at best, we can try to work so that we have a good death, which is wonderful. And of course, this is included in the teaching, how to live well, how to die well, how to be able to let go so that we have a peaceful death and hopefully experience peace after death. But the Buddha went even further. He wanted to find a way out of dying altogether and to a place which was free from impermanence, free from birth, age, aging, sickness, and death. So from this time, he discovered that there were two kinds of search. And this is in a sutta called the Arya Pariyasana Sutta from Majjhima Nikaya number 26, for those who may wish to read this afterwards. And it's very beautiful because he's expressing his own reason for going forth. So he says, why myself, being subject to birth, aging, sickness, and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, do I seek what is also subject to these things? Suppose that, being myself subject to these things, and having understood the danger in these things, the suffering, the danger of being attached to these things, why don't I seek the end of birth, aging, sickness, and death? The undefiled, supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. And sometimes Nibbana is talked about as the deathless. It's not exactly a state or a place, but it is free from dying, free from birth and death. Sometimes instead of the deathless, my teacher Ajahn Brahm, and I like this too, prefers to call it the end of dying or no more dying. So it's the place where all birth and death ceases once and for all, and that's why it's the highest happiness. And then he says, what is subject to death? Partners, children, it says servants, but I've changed it to helpers, colleagues, friends, animals, pets, livelihood. It might include our wealth, our cars. This guy that I met in the train said he was really upset that his new bicycle got completely destroyed. Even though he was extremely grateful to be alive, but still there was this suffering, you know, of having to let go of his dear bike, which was probably very expensive. So the problem here is that one who is tied, infatuated, and utterly committed to these things, being oneself subject to death, is basically seeking what is also subject to death. So rather than that, we try to live every day as though it could be our last, right? We try to understand that these attachments are causing us to bind ourselves in a way that's really not helpful and not actually allowing us to enjoy what we have while it's there. One of the death reflections that the Buddha praised was to imagine while you're breathing that each breath could be your last, or while you're eating your food that each morsel could be your last. Not only that this day could be your last day, but that this breath could be your last. And it's in this way, you know, that we develop enormous amounts of presence. We come to the here and now, to this moment, and stop living in this kind of dreamland of the past and the future. It becomes much, much easier to let go of resentments, of grudges, of worrying, as I say, about really trivial things, you know, or planning for the future excessively. A little bit of planning is fine, you know. To create our monastery, I had to have a vision. I had to have really strong reasons and quite a lot of conviction as to why this was necessary, to rouse the energy necessary to have that commitment and sustain myself through all the ups and downs. But at the same time, it was being able to resource myself in the present moment that really gave me the energy to take each step. And this is something that brings a sense of immediacy to our practice. You know, if this was your last breath, could you be aware of that breath? With kindness, could you be fully present to that breath and enjoy it fully and rest the mind there? That's a high practice, right? And we might not get to that point today, but at least we can think about how we might spend our time, maybe if we had just 3 months to live. How do we know we have more than that? How do we know we even have 3 months? Is this scary? No, a little bit and no. Yeah, it's an interesting one, because intellectually sometimes it's not so scary because we think we know that. But when we actually start meditating with it, it can bring up a sense of fear. So part of the process is learning to turn towards the fears, you know, the kind of barriers and denial that we have towards facing our own mortality, the question of death. And like everything in the Buddha's teachings, it's very compassionate. So the first noble truth of suffering is to be understood. The Buddha wants us to actually start facing the reality of death and dying and suffering in ourselves, but to do so gently, to do so with a lot of tenderness, a lot of compassion, and step by step. So we're gradually familiarizing ourselves with this idea, not all at once, so that we can turn towards it in a way that starts to loosen our attachments. And the second noble truth is all about the cause of suffering, which is that craving, that desire, that clinging, you know, the things that we simply cannot let go of. So again, the Buddha's not asking us to let go of the beautiful things in our lives. He's not saying there's no happiness to be found in beautiful friendships or relationships or even having nice possessions and a comfortable house. But he is saying that the clinging we have towards these things is going to pile on unnecessary suffering that simply doesn't need to be there. And the more we can learn to let go in our lives, you know, the more we can learn to relate to the people in our lives with kindness, with a sense of gratitude, not with a sense of possession and control, right? Understanding that they don't belong to us, they're not ours. Is that right? Even your husband, your wife, your partner is not yours, right? They're companions that are by our side for now and that can help us to grow on the path. But ultimately, we have to go our own way at some time. They don't belong to us. And when we realize this, we can start treating them with a lot more respect. I think it was Ajahn Chah who gave this beautiful simile of the glass. Okay, I have a glass. So he said, see this glass. Do you see the crack in the glass? Can you see a crack? Is there a crack? You might not be able to see the crack, but the crack is there. Does that mean you can't use the glass? Can you use the glass? You can still use it. But because there's a crack inherent in the glass, we have to use it with a lot more care. It's not that because there's a crack in the glass, we chuck the glass onto the floor, let it smash, don't use it, it's useless, you know, get rid of our attachments, throw all our things away. That's not what we do. But we recognize there's a crack, there's fragility in this glass. Although it seems really strong and solid, if it comes into contact with the concrete floor, it will smash. So we take more care of it than we ever would if it was permanent. And in the same way, this is how we can start relating to the people in our lives. You know, again, when we talk about impermanence, we can look at momentary impermanence. We can look at how things change over time. And I'm sure that, you know, all of you have noticed changes in your body, changes in your mind, maybe even changes in your views of the world. Maybe political ideologies have changed over time. You know, you maybe you've even changed your name. I don't know. Shaved your head or whatever it might be. But with death, we're talking about impermanence in a really big way. We're talking about things disappearing forever, human beings being no more. How many of you remember or had a relationship that you can really remember with your great-grandparents? Anyone? You did? Yeah, a few. A few, yeah. Great-great-grandparents? Great-greats? No. You did? That's amazing, gosh. But how many people, you know, in your family or in your community would remember them now? Probably not many, right? No matter what their accomplishments and achievements, eventually they're forgotten. They're not even in the history books. I remember going to Hamburg many years ago, and that was really interesting because I asked them. We went to this enormous graveyard in Hamburg, which had like separate sections for the Jewish community and for the Chinese community. It was enormous. And I asked how many graves on approximately there were, and they told me about 1 million. And I asked them how many people lived in Hamburg, I think at another time, and there were about 1 million. So there were as many people above the ground as there were underneath. And that was incredibly sobering, you know, because then when I looked around, like I'm looking in this room now, maybe 70 or 80 people, there were the equivalent number of people underground in that same town. I mean, here there's going to be more than that, obviously. I don't know. There's probably far more people, actually, who are dead than who are alive today, right? So this is big impermanence. And there's another sutta called the Ratapala Sutta where I love this phrase. It says something like the whole world is swept away. The whole world is swept away. We can see this now with climate crisis. You can't really call it change. You know, things are being swept away. Whole icebergs are melting. You know, whenever there's a landslide, the whole side of the mountain slides down. There are earthquakes. I read about an earthquake in Myanmar this morning. In Sagaing Hills, Mandalay, but it spreads to Sagaing Hills, places where there are like thousands, if not tens of thousands of monasteries, you know, just crumbling into dust. So this is a reality, whole species becoming extinct. So if we really can contemplate this, how would we choose to live our lives? If you only had 3 months left, are there things that you would drop? Are there things that you'd prioritize? I mean, of course, there's things we would drop, like paying the bills, but we have to do that. So, right? I mean, but still, how could we really find more space for the things that matter? How could we find more time to cultivate a familiarity with letting go? And the joy in letting go. I haven't spoken much about the joy this morning, but we'll do that this afternoon. Again, the Buddha's pointing to the places we suffer to rouse a wish to be free from that suffering, to instill in us a sense of there is something more, there is something beyond the realm of birth and death. There is freedom to be found by walking this path. So this is the reason he's pointing us to the areas that are not going to bring lasting satisfaction and refuge. And we can't really bargain with this. I'll tell you one funny story to end, because I think sometimes we can think that we're free from attachment, or we can hope that we are, or we can find tricks to kind of, not have to think about it too much. But in the end, it all depends on how much work we've done in this life, how much we've been able to live with love, with compassion, with a sense of letting go, of giving, not just acquiring, but being able to share, being able to give things away. So a funny little story is also from, I think Ajahn Brahm told this. He's the one with the stories, so I just picked them up about 25th hand or something. But I still like this, it's really nice. So there was this businessman, and he was always very busy running around in the world. And, he realized that he was getting a bit older, and suddenly he was really sick and he had to go to hospital. So he thought, oh no, now I have to go to hospital. Maybe I'm going to die. Oh, what did the Buddha say I should do? What did he say? Oh, I have to take refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Okay, how do I do that? I'm not going to remember. How will I do this? And then he came up with a great idea, a real shortcut at the time of his death. So he decided that he had these three, I mean, in the story, it's always men, isn't it? But let's say he had one son and two daughters. And he realized that he was very attached to them, and he'd want them there on his the time of his death. So he thought, how can I not forget the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha? I know, I'll rename them. I'll rename them Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, so that when I see them at the time of my death, I'll remember Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. So that's what he did. And he even got them to change their name by deed poll. Can you imagine? So they went to all that trouble to protect their father in the last moments of his life. So lo and behold, there he is on his deathbed, about to die. And the practice worked. Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. Buddha. Oh no, if all my three kids are here, who's looking after the shop? And that was his last thought. And then he died. So it didn't work. So we can't leave it until the last moment. We can't take refuge only with our head, but really not knowing what on earth we're doing. We actually have to have some kind of inner refuge within. And the Buddha said, that inner refuge is the qualities we've developed. There's a beautiful verse in the Dhammapada which says, it's better to have lived a single day mindful, and actually it says in jhana, the actual word is jayati, which means, let's say, meditative, okay, so mindful and with a meditative mind, than it is to live 100 years without any mindfulness and bereft of any kind of sense of composure or steadiness of mind. Better it is to live a single day. So even if we can develop awareness of a single breath, even if we can be kind or just smile that little bit more, just have a moment of loving kindness as we wake up, as we go to bed, still your life is more worthwhile in that moment, on that day, than it would be if you'd lived 100 days heedless, thoughtless, forgetting all about your death, no recollection of the things that you have in your life to be grateful for. So this is the, you know, on, in a way, it's a very huge message. It's a huge topic. We're talking about something profound, actually seeking the end of dying. And in another way, it's something very simple that can bring a sense of immediacy to our lives right now and just make us more aware about not only what we're doing, but why. You know, is this really how I want to be spending my time? The days and the nights are relentlessly passing, the Buddha said. How well am I spending my time? Can we bring more love to the way that we're aware? Can we have a better sense of perspective, a more values-aligned life, you know, that actually looks not only for our own well-being and what we can gain, but also what we can give, what we can share? So these are some reflections, and hopefully just by coming to a retreat like this, we start to contemplate, we start to get inspired to think about death so that when it does come, it comes as less of a shock. And we gradually get, again, that sense of familiarity. We can start to change our attitude towards death and dying and even sickness, even pain, pain in the body, the fragility of the body. We don't often like to show our vulnerability, our fragileness. I wasn't feeling particularly confident about coming here on so little sleep, having had a very, very busy few weeks. But I've learned to just show up the way I am. And hopefully that makes me a little bit more open to the way all of you are as well, right? I can see that many of us are weary. Many of us are kind of, you know, struggling with something in our lives. And we're all in this together. So we change our attitude towards it and we start to embrace the idea of death as something that can bring us together. It can be a great equalizer because none of us are immune from this. If I could just look at any of you and realize that, you know, I might not see you again, then that would bring a great deal more appreciation and gratitude for the fact that we have this day to share. Right? So see if we can think like that towards people we don't even like, and see if we can just let go of a few of those resentments and grudges that we hold that really we wouldn't want to die with. You know, we would want to be able to let that go at the time of our death.